Hi there, friends. This is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind, here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. A little help from Vangelis. Because when I hear Vangelis, I think about Chariots of Fire. I think about the 80s. I think about motivation. And today, that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about motivation, what moves you, what inspires you, what drives you. That's what we're going to look at. Lucky to have with me today two helpers, researchers, co-authors, Dr. Sherry Siegel. With me, as usual, on Wednesdays. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Armand.
And Lauren Sykes, who's a researcher and assistant, has been joining us, helping us put this all together.
Hello, Armand.
And it's so nice to be able to cover this in such an interesting way.
Drive was something that I began to think about recently. I thought of two men that I know. One was content to sit in his chair, look at the television, get something to eat once in a while, take a nap, do a crossword puzzle. And another one, almost the same age, was motivated to become not only a doctor, but a dentist, a double doctor, someone who had degrees in different types of medicine, a dentist, a vice president in a company. And these two people could not have been more different. Yet they both did the things that they needed to do. What drove one of them so hard to get degrees and climb in a corporation, and the other person to sit back and just take life a meal at a time? I wanted to understand that a little bit better. So today, Lauren and Armand and I are going to talk about what it is in the brain. Is it inside the person? Or is it outside in the world? Do we learn this, or are we born with that drive? Really wonder about that. We certainly know a little bit about animals who are driven to survive. But humans, we do more than survive. What
seems to be a lot of different things that motivate us. And, you know, just to give you an example of it, there was one theorist who said there were 6,000 people. And the 6,000 people, Stephen Rice, he talked about a theory of 16 basic, now he didn't call these drives, but he said these were desires. Desires.
And so desire is different than drive. A drive is something subconscious, although there are lots of different theories. There's the drive that comes from the inside, the drive, say, to satisfy our hunger, to keep the race going. And then there are drives that come from the outside, drives like approval, getting approval from people, or achieving in life. So those are drives that come from the outside. They're called extrinsic, and then inside, they're called intrinsic drives. Stephen Rice comes up with a list of these different desires. One of them is acceptance, or the need for approval.
Okay, so now we're crossing over from motivation to desires. And there is a crossover here. I mean, it's kind of like we can talk about real motivation and real drives, but let's just, here comes this list that Stephen Rice did. He quotes one, he says, an important thing. He said, people will work for pennies. People will work for acceptance. Okay, so that's one of the drives.
People also have the need for romance, the need for sex.
Okay. People have curiosity. Now it's he determined that among the things that motivate people is curiosity.
And so one doesn't think of curiosity as a drive, but it's a desire. So some people act on
the desires.
But
then there are people who are not. You know, so what these are, and we'll give you the list of desires so it doesn't confuse you. But according to the motivations he found, people reported eating, family, the need to have family and raise children. Like, that's an intrinsic need, according to Stephen Rice, who had seven children. He said honor. He said the need to be loyal to the traditional value of one's clan or ethnic group. You can imagine what his father was like. Idealism, the need for social justice. You know, one thinks, you know, as we think about some of what's going on in the world, well, if this is such a need, how come so few people have it? If we have cultures who believe that their social justice comes at the cost of someone else's. Independence, the need for individuality. Well, you know, according to his list of basic desires, he talks about independence and the need for individuality, but then he talks about honoring your parents and making sure you keep the traditions. They get at odds with each other, so this is not all in the same person. He does talk about the need for order. Now, order is a very interesting thing. We don't need order. But it does seem that humans in chaos tend to always organize. Animals in chaos tend to organize. Let's look at some of the other desires.
Some of the other desires are the physical, the need for physical activity, so to exercise.
Or if not even to exercise, to move.
To move.
You got to keep that thing in motion.
Also the need for savings. You need some type of wealth, some type of abundance in order to survive. Also the need for power and the influence that you have over others. And to tie in with that, there's also status, so your need for social standing and importance amongst your peers. Also tranquility, the need to be safe and away from danger. And then there's vengeance, the need to feel revenge against those that have done you wrong.
Now, it's very interesting because I remember a book. I had a friend who was a script writer, and he told me about a book called 36 Dramatic Situations. Or was it 72? I'm not sure. But these were, somebody had taken all of Shakespeare, and they said, you know, there's just this repetitive 36 different situations. And he talked about each one. You could see the need for acceptance is the basis of a book, you know. And he said every dramatic situation in life can be somehow positioned among these things, and I'll read them again to you. The need for acceptance. Can you imagine a movie about acceptance? Of course.
Or a conflict about acceptance. Mm-hmm. That's the basis of so many different movies and books.
Sure. Curiosity. The need to learn. Of course. Every explorer movie, everything we do. The need for food and survival that way. The need for family. This is all the drama that people get involved in.
And honor and independence, when those things are not allowed, how people fight back.
Idealism. You know, we're writing the scripts for all the movies that we all go to see. The need for vengeance. You know, revenge is a big motivation in movies. The need to be safe and tranquility, another big motivation in movies. And, of course, relationships, power, influence. So here comes the question now. Is this really what motivates us? Or what is motivation? Does it have something to do with this?
And also, with motivation, why are some more motivated than others? What is the difference between drive and maybe compulsion? So there's an author named Daniel Pink who has touched on this subject, and he suggested these three different levels that could be described as three different driving forces, but you might want to also look at them as three different levels that must be reached. So the first level is our basic need for survival, which would be food, clothing, and shelter. The second that would be reached would be to avoid punishment and to gain reward, which is the basic need to just avoid being hurt and gaining abundance, gaining your wealth. And then lastly, the one that's very fairly rarely ever reached would be the joy that you get at actually accomplishing your goals. So it's not the destination, but it's the journey along the way.
It's both. That's great. That's well said. So there's a need, you're saying, to try to get your goals.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a need when you get your goals.
Exactly. And the need of joy as you're accomplishing these goals. So it's not just a set goal, but it's what it took to get you to that point.
Mm.
So where does motivation and drive come from in the brain? That was something that I was interested in. And looking,
is it in the brain?
Oh, without a doubt.
I don't know. You look at my big toe. I got a lot of motivation in there. How do we know it's in the brain? Because we assume it's a thinking process?
Well, it's a great question. What we know is, of course, from looking at animals. And one thing that we understand is that the hypothalamus, that's the center, the thalamus is the area of the brain that talks to the rest of the brain and puts everything together. It's the commander in chief.
Is the thalamus the one that's kind of rowing the ship?
That's how I think of it. Yes, it connects the basic lizard part of us to the thinking, analyzing part.
You know,
of
I've
us.
Been thinking more and more, Sherry, since you mentioned it, about the community of the brain and how we don't really perceive the brain. Yesterday we had a guest on who was talking about, he talked about the forest floor of the brain. He said it's like, you know, it's a garden up there, and every piece is in harmony with another piece, and they're all working together. And you're saying that one of the major composers here is the thalamus.
That's exactly right. That's a great way to look at it, like a garden, and the basic part, or the floor of the forest, is the brain stem. That's the part of our brain that tells us to breathe, to eat, to do all different things. And an in-between place from the big part, the thinking part of the brain, and the basic part of the brain is the hypothalamus. There are areas of the hypothalamus, and there are fancy words, the ventromedial part and the paraventricular nuclei.
Well, our audience likes to learn these words, so.
And they're great words.
Let's give it to them. You know, you want to be able to drop them at a. At a
party.
At a
yes,
party,
a cocktail yeah. party. Yes, my.
My ventromedial is responding to your paraventricular nuclei.
Exactly. Well, they're very important because those are areas that drive us to eat food and to stop eating food when we've had enough. And the things that influence them are our hormones, hormones like insulin. We've heard of insulin. That's very important to control blood sugar, how much sugar is in the blood and how much goes into the cells. And then there's leptin and ghrelin. Those are new hormones. Ghrelin is what is active or floating around when we feel we're hungry and our stomach is growling. And leptin is the hormone that makes us feel satisfied. And we can say, enough, push the plate away.
Wait a minute. Ghrelin is when I've had enough pizza?
It's the other way around. Ghrelin says, man, I want pizza.
Ghrelin is what motivates us. We have ghrelin.
Well, they actually both motivate us, if you think about it. One motivates us to go get the pizza, and one motivates us to say, I've had enough. If I eat more, I'm not going to feel good.
Now, they say that damage to either of these areas, and I think some of us chunky folks sometimes wonder why we can't stop eating. And it seems that I was looking at some of the theory of what was behind the drug Acomplia when it first came out, that it went into, what they did was they accessed the very same site that is where marijuana users, tetrahydrocannabinol, has this kind of key. And people who smoke marijuana know they can get very hungry. And what it turns out is that THC tends to shut off the part of the brain that says you've had enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the theory was that if we could shut off that part of the brain, if we could turn on the part of the brain that says you've had enough with very heavy people, they would stop eating.
Mm.
So they developed a drug called Acomplia. And this drug was supposed to come out, and it did just that. They turned off that site. But, of course, the drug was found to be illegal. The drug was found to be dangerous because supposedly it led people to commit suicide once again. But what it really was, I think, is a case of Sanofi, who was a European drug company, was trying to get in on the U.S. market, and the U.S. market just kept them out. I thought it was political. But the idea was that there is a spot in the brain that some of us have and some of us don't have. And that's why some of us say, I think I'll eat that whole box of donuts. Mm-hmm. And the rest of us say, I think I'll have just one.
Well, that's how the hypothalamus is organized. You've got pairs of nuclei. One is the excitatory pair and the nucleus, and the other is the quieting nucleus. And if you stimulate stimulate that one of the parts of the brain, it will cause an overreaction, an overactivity. And if you lesion that part of the brain, it will stop the activity.
Explain what lesion means.
Lesion means if you cut it, or if you put a chemical in and harm that part of the brain. But what happens over time, because it's so important for the body to continue the drives, those drives will reorganize.
So if you lesion the part of the brain that imagines color, right, and you lesion that part, meaning you cut it, you interrupt it, you cut the nerve, or whatever you do, the brain is going to reorganize to, well, it may not get to see color, but it would compensate for not being able to see that color. If every time you saw the color red, you knew you should run away, the brain is going to reorganize so that it does something else to make you run away when that color red appears.
So that you're protected. Basically, the whole bottom line is protect the body, help it survive.
Help it survive. And even helping it survive may be repeating terrible habits, like repeating things that got you through, like when you were a kid. If you grew up in an abusive family, and when you were abused, you ran to your room and you closed your door and you laid down on your bed and you cried. But all that time that you finally got in your room, you eventually calmed down and felt safe. Now, safety becomes associated with retreat for some people. So what they do is they go to relationships where they have abusive relationships, so that somehow some part of their body is calling for, find me that retreat safety. And how are you going to find me that retreat safety? By finding somebody abusive. So here we have complex motivation, which works on both chemical and psychological, and probably an interaction of the two.
No question about it. There are unconscious or subconscious drives, because we have external triggers, we'll say. That's clear. It's very easy to know if someone is threatening us with a knife. Well, we're going to run the other way. But then there are internal or subconscious motivators that we've utilized so many times in our lives. It's become so innate. It's almost something we don't think about, that we just naturally go there. Those are our subconscious.
Like what?
Well, I think the example you gave was great, but I think of someone who was with their uncle, say, for example, when they were a child, and they were pre-verbal children, and this uncle was abusive, physically and sexually abusive. And the man had, say, a beard. So every time this person grew up seeing someone with a beard, they became afraid, and their bodies responded. So they had that fight or flight reaction. Their pupils got small. They wanted to, their muscles tensed, getting ready to run away from this person. So those are the things that become unconscious drives. Sometimes those drives take us away from the things that we want to do. I mean, if we, for example, we are fearful of old bearded men, it'd be very difficult to walk
around.
Well,
a good example of it is the two guys you were talking about earlier. One of them sits in a chair and he'll watch television all day long and not motivated to do anything, even though he's a nice guy. And the other guy is like a house on fire. So one asks the question, did some part of the house on fire's brain say, never sit still, you're never safe, keep going, keep going, keep going? That's his brain working. Because some part of him, maybe even as a spermatozoa, found a danger or something. You know, you never know when it happened. Or genetically, something said you're just not one of the safe ones. Because we know people can be born with dispositions of fear, you know. And then the other guy, they said, sit down and don't make any trouble. And so when he was a kid, he decided he wasn't going to make any trouble. So all he's going to do is sit there all the time and be a good boy for mommy, you know? And that's his motivation. That's what drives me. So when you go to him and you say to him, come on, get up, let's go to the movies, he says, no, I feel more peace sitting here. All right, I'll go if it makes you happy. But I feel more peace. I found my safety here, you know?
Safety, I think that's a key word.
Key word for motivation and drives.
Right, right. That when someone is safe, they think, why change? Why act? I'm safe here. If I don't move, I don't journey into the unknown.
Or disturb the balance.
Or disturb the balance.
What do you mean by that? Disturb the balance.
Well, you see, when you're safe, usually you've attained your homeostasis. You're complacent, you're fine. So there's no real need to disturb your body or your mind because you're tranquil. and you feel safe.
I don't think there is a search for homeostasis. I think, what was his name? It's part of the study we're doing here for the ever-ready potential. You know the potential, yeah, that there's a search for a point. We look to be homeostatic. We look to be at peace.
Mm-hmm.
But we always want to be a little bit charged.
Okay.
We want to be ready to fire.
Okay.
Now, that's the ideal condition. Calm but alert is the ideal condition,
mm-hmm.
it seems. So what we look for is calm and alert. But now let's go back to the idea of safety. Safety is such an important issue because it seems that all of this, and I'm trying to look of which of the drives is not related to safety. Sex? Is sex related to safety? Is the need to procreate related to safety? Do we have a genetically inherited need to keep the species going? So the safety of the species goes along with the safety of our individual self? What do you think?
I think it's a big question for an individual mm-hmm. to take on. So it's hard to imagine that an individual takes on that responsibility. But I think, going way back to evolution, that it's those who didn't procreate, who didn't survive. So that one of the very, very extremely basic drives is the drive to procreate.
Okay, and what motivates us? Let's keep going with this. So the things that motivate us, you remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
That we have to satisfy the very basic needs first, and as the most basic needs get satisfied, then we satisfy the slightly less basic needs.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk much more about this. I am with Dr. Sherry Siegel and Lauren Sykes, and we've been researching this whole idea of motivation, incentives, desires, and drives. You know, it sounds like the name of a TV series. Motivation, incentives, desires, and drives.
Rock group.
Let's talk about the inside and outside the organization. Motivations and incentives.
So, certainly, if you look on the inside, you have internal motivations. You have mechanisms that motivate us. And those motivations are really talked about or considered drives. And if you look at animals, these motivations can be taught, and some of them are innate. Because a lot of times we think of a drive to be something that we're born with. But studies were done on animals where they were rewarded with a lot of pellets. And so they looked at one group who were given more pellets, the faster they run. Another group, no, I'm not saying that right. Just one back up one step. Rats were given pellets. When the amount of pellets were increased, they ran faster. When the amount of pellets that were given were decreased, they slowed down. They were less motivated.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very interesting to think this is not just an internal desire of the rats to seek food or reward. It was something that came from the outside. It was something that they learned.
Hmm. So motivational state of drive, an internal condition which can change over time. And now that, again, is a very important thing. Since stuff can be motivated from the inside, like hunger, thirst, curiosity, sexual desire. You know, sexual desire of a 16-year-old is very different than the sexual desire of a 21-year-old and a 30-year-old and a 40-year-old and a 50-year-old, except for certain perennial adolescents who just keep it going the whole time. And for them, you know, their job is get out there and make babies or spill the seed is the whole idea. That's for them, but it changes over time, and the motivation behind it changes. What you have to pay for it in some way or other changes. Do you dedicate your whole life? I was looking at some movies from the deep under the sea, animals from way down deep, and what they do. And I was looking about how they procreate and what they do to try to beat each other out to be able to produce more species and keep them going. It's amazing. It's amazing how your entire life is about one thing, that there are certain forms of shrimp that have only one motive in life, to have a baby. That's it, and then they could die. You know, have a child or have 1,000 children and then die. You know, that's it. That's the whole motive, or the whole idea of the bees and the queen bee, or the ants and the queen ant, and all of that at all times. Those are motivations that kind of move us. But I'm kind of interested in another kind of motivation as well. I'm kind of interested in what turns off those other motivations, like the motivation to be kind, the motivation to be fair, the motivation to take the high road, the motivation. Those are the things that touch me. Because the other ones, the impulses, I can understand. You know, basic stuff I can understand. And we're going to go through this with you and teach you much more about it. But I wonder what happens to people at a certain point. Like, I remember before 9/11, there was a kind of a familial feeling. We were all in revolt. We were all working together. We were saying, we don't like the way things are. And there was a certain aliveness in our rebellion. We were fighting to keep things good. And then 9/11 happened, and then this overwhelming squelch took place. If you think of it as, if you think of the Bush years as the oil spill on humanity, somehow it crushed everybody's desire, not everybody, but most people's desire to rebel. And the rebellion got quieted more and more and more, and you see it socially, the rebellion, as we watch ourselves destroy things. So today, I want to take a look at it, but I want to make a certain dedication of time to recognizing and acknowledging this incredible disaster that we're facing in Louisiana and the Gulf. This incredible social thing. So we're going to take a short break for some station identification. And when we come back, I'm going to bring you some music and some thoughts. But the music I'm going to bring you specifically is for us to pause and give recognition to what's really happening with probably the worst ecological disaster in human history as we sit here and do radio. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not somebody who's just here to make you feel bad. But geez, to be ignoring this the way we are, that's a different story. So I want to kind of bring it away from that and try to bring up our consciousness a little bit, which I will do as soon as we get back. So right now we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue this process. Evangelist. And I thought of it because it's called The Single Balloon. And it's called from an album, an old album, called The Apocalypse of the Animals. And this is what touches me so much. To think as we are part of this and we look at it, and we don't even want to see the photographs of the oily birds and stuff, but to think that an ecosystem is being annihilated, destroyed, gone, and we can't do anything about it. Nothing. We can't stand up there and fight. We can't build a wall. We can't throw our bodies in the water. We are watching the destruction of millions of animals, life forms, plankton, coral. And we have nothing to do but watch it and say, oh, I don't even want to hear about it. And I know some people say, I don't want to look at the pictures. So I want to take a moment of sadness to mourn and grieve that little piece of our earth that we are losing because we're too powerless and because we let this happen. Thank you. Thank you for joining me, those of you who stuck around. Sometimes I feel so powerless. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Sherry Siegel and Lauren Sykes. We're talking about... Well, I don't know. Before I go any further, is there anything you want to say about that, Sherry?
Just Armand, that I'm grateful that you took a moment to help us just think, let our minds go there, and let our hearts grieve, because it is a terrible tragedy. I think there will be recovery. That's my optimism coming through. I believe there will be recovery, but there will be a lot of suffering. There already is a lot of suffering on the part of the animals and on the part of the people that live there and live off of the ocean, off the Gulf, rather. So right now people are suffering. All of us are suffering with them. But I believe that there is recovery in the offing.
We should hope. It's going to be a different recovery, though. You see, we're going to come back as a different animal because we've destroyed a good piece of what we are. So it's going to be like, you know, we'll recover from nuclear war, too. But we're going to come back with three heads. You know, we're going to have four arms. We're going to be different. And I think this is going to motivate us. In some way, we have to adjust. I mean, how many years did we have to scream, don't depend on foreign oil, don't depend on oil, period, that there's a danger to letting oil? We could have done so many things, solar power, electric. We could have done so many other things. How many years did it take for us to finally pay attention? And then when we finally do, and there's a moratorium put on all drilling, some guy down in Louisiana says, oh, no, that's not fair. You can't stop the drilling. Well, he's got personal investments in oil companies. You know, but it's like, where are we? What are we? Who are we? What drives us? So what drives me is knowing that I'm a part of something good and beautiful. I think this program, The Positive Mind and WBAI, is something good and beautiful. I think everybody who's a part of this program and this station is in some way part of the goodness that I want to be a part of. And if I don't have that, I don't have anything. If I don't have that, money doesn't make a difference. Health doesn't make a difference. I just have to be part of what's good. I'm not saying that I'm a good guy. I want to be a part of the goodness.
I think the goodness that you put out goes out on the airwaves, and I don't know, sometimes when I sit here, I feel a lot of goodness coming back from people who call in, people sometimes who make donations, just people who are listening. I can hear people listening out there, and all the emails that you get from people who've listened for so many years, that part of the good, that moves a lot of things. We may not see it, but we can feel it.
This is Armand DeMille with Lauren Sykes. Lauren, do you want to say anything?
No, I just to bounce off of what Dr. Siegel just said, definitely, you never know how much you affect others until they show you. And I think that has definitely been shown with this program, that you do reach out to people. People are definitely moved. And you never know how much you do truly affect people.
And, you know, part of what we do is try to leave room for you to call in. And we want to do that today. We want to be able to get a few of you callers. I know I've thrown some food out there for a lot of people to come in with their angry vituperations, and you know, they're just going to come in screaming at the government and screaming at the oil drillers and all that stuff. We're a part of it, friends. I mean, don't disown how we played a part in all of it. And we play a part in all of it. Just because there's somebody there who's putting the drill in the ground. Remember, we like those comforts too.
You know, we're talking about drives in individuals a lot today. What drives us as an individual, but really, we're driven as humanity by many different things. And so, the whole human organism, or the whole American organism, or all the different corporate organisms. There's so many organisms that, you know, that are driven by different things, by wealth, by greed, by goodness, by helping. So it's not just the individual in which there's a drive. There's a collective brain for animals and for we human animals that drive us.
You've just answered it. You know what we need on this planet? We need a thalamus. We need a thalamus. You know, we don't have a good thalamus working.
Yes,
we have everybody working against each other. Imagine now, Sherry, what happens in the brain when pieces work against each other? Doesn't that happen?
It does. It does.
What
usually
kind of neurological condition do you have where one brain is doing one thing? It's like, for example, your heartbeat. You know, you suddenly start having a rapid heartbeat because the body believes you've got to get more oxygen, right? It's pumping faster, faster, faster on one hand. On the other hand, it's sending a stroke up through your brain.
Right. It reminds me of when the temporal lobe, which is the part of the brain that helps us hear things, it does a lot of other things, but one of the things it does is hear things. And we frequently hear voices. We hear people talking. Sometimes we hear the voice in our head, but we usually can tell when it's a voice in our head and it's just innocuous. It's just a thought passing through. But sometimes when that part of our brain is not functioning normally, then suddenly those voices begin to seem as if they are coming from outside, being broadcast by radio or by television, and we can't differentiate.
And you know, and sometimes it just, we believe it's our own thinking. I've watched people start thinking after they say, you know, well, I'm really lazy, which could come from any number of lethargic syndromes in the body. And then all of a sudden they start believing that the outside voices that they internalized became real because they're now, because I think it, therefore I'm real. I think, therefore I am, may be a mistake, you know.
Right.
You know, Descartes. Got to go back and reframe that a little bit. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind of Sherry Siegel. We do have a telephone number here, 212-209-2900. We will start taking calls. Michael, you cue us whenever you get a call. 212-209-2900.
You know, earlier we were talking about romantic love, and really I think we think of romantic love as being just an emotional, nice icing on the cake of the sexual drive that we have. But more and more, fMRI studies are showing that romantic love is less about emotions and more about rewards and the parts of the brain that control motivation, which is such a surprise. I think we think of that as just a lightweight part of the sexual drive, but actually it's extremely important.
Well, you know, I used to call falling in love finding a plus for your minus. That's what I would say, you know, that when you fall in love, meaning when you found the ideal partner, you found the plus for your minus. And it's like Lauren was saying before, we have a system, and the system is seeking to have its balance. It's looking for this equilibrium. And when it finds the spot, it finds a person who could present it. Like, sometimes you need a hero on a white knight, you know, no, on a white horse. Sometimes you need that. Sometimes you need a good friend. Sometimes you need just a lover. But you're somehow your chemistry is searching out a person, and that could be anything from genetics to hormones to, and it's not just your thinking. It's not that just you think, oh, if they've got nice teeth, they're okay. That's what I like. I like people who wear good shoes. That's such primitive stuff. You know, it comes from a place. There's a part of you that needs somebody with good shoes because you need somebody who could run away, and you need somebody who has got good teeth. Because you need somebody who could defend you.
Yeah, and so if you think about romance and the things that draw us to romance, what happens in romance? We become infatuated. When we're infatuated, our hormone level increases, oxytocin. So our oxytocin then binds us or connects us to the other person, makes us want to have intimacy with that person, and hence sex often comes out of that, babies come out of that. The human race or the animal race is continued as a result.
Well, you know, if you follow the Lady Gaga formula, the Lady Gaga formula, it isn't just oxytocin that motivates you. Sometimes all you want is a dopaminergic exchange. You know, let me have some fire, right? And it's just the fire I need because I'm depressed and I want to go out there and I want to find somebody who's going to push me around and beat me up and compete with me. And that's what will motivate me.
That's an interesting take on it, that it's not just about the feeling of love, but it's about the feeling that you get from love, the reward, the euphoric, the euphoric win that you're caught up in. So it's not even just about the sex. It's more about the romance and the hormones and the feeling that you get from finding this mate.
So the phrase more is, I love myself when I'm with you.
When I'm with you, exactly.
Rather than I love you.
Exactly.
But I love myself when I have you available to me. I feel better.
Exactly.
Going back to that idea of safety. 212-209-2900. Let's take a call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Oh, nobody there. Go ahead.
You know, I'll just tell you that Arthur Aaron from SUNY Stony Brook did fMRI, functional MRI, that takes pictures of the activity in the brain, not just a picture of the brain as it is, but what the brain is doing. And he and his colleagues found that early stage love, intense romantic love, is associated with what they called subcortical reward regions that are rich with dopamine, as you were talking about. Subcortical are the things just below the outer level, outer layer of the brain. And that romantic love engages the brain systems that are associated with motivation to acquire a reward. And I suppose for men and women, it could be sex.
212-209-2900, there is a call here. Let's take it. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille. Hello there. We just got to sync. We'll get it synced in a minute.
Hello.
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 This is Armand?
Yes, it is.
Hello.
Speak up, we're going to move on.
I'm speaking up.
Okay, we can hear you. Go ahead. He can't hear us. It's been after the marathon. You know, Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Armand?
Good.
Interesting show. I'd like to talk about the RH factor in the brain, the reptilian brain. which I believe is like the oldest part of the brain that controls the flight or fight responses. Because I'm dealing with something like that right now in an interpersonal way.
Tell me about it.
Well,
Are you running or is she?
Yes, she.
She's running
away.
She's
running. Yes.
There you have somebody who you need and care about and depend on one level, and in some way she's kind of pushing you at a distance.
Definitely. And the distance has been made in a way that it almost seems irreconcilable.
Sure. Sure. And that's what distance is meant to do. You know, it's meant to kind of get to a point where you can't get it back.
Where you can't get it back.
And so the part of you gets desperate. And in your desperation, you call, you email, you send text messages. You try to make her feel guilty. What do you do?
Well, I've tried to guilt her a lot in the past, but I think that with your help, because I've spoken to you before. My name is Joe. I'll keep it a Joe. And I've tried to guilt my partner into considering her thought processes. But I'm seeing it now that in doing that, I was pushing against a pre-existing condition, and it made the response almost like obvious. You know what I mean? In a way that, you know, when you rebel against something or you need something to rebel against and you push, the other person's going to push back. And that's where I am right now in my relationship. And it's a relationship that I've treasured. My anniversary, my 25th anniversary was on Monday, and, like, I do have a lot of anger because I'm dealing with a person who knows on an intellectual level, I feel, knows better, but on a deep emotional level, she's doing exactly what the situation requires.
Now, and, you know, you're talking about something that is so difficult and so painful that you're fighting off your own tears all the time.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I hear it.
Yeah,
I hear it.
I am.
You know, it's so sad to break with somebody like that and then to feel powerless. I said earlier, you know, one of the feelings that I have the greatest difficulty with regarding what's happening in the Gulf is this powerlessness I feel. To feel powerless is such a difficult thing because it makes you so vulnerable and so open, like somebody could just, you know, eat you up and spit you out. And you're going through one of the most difficult things, this thing of separation. But here's the problem. The problem is if you don't let yourself grieve, if you don't let it go, you're going to hang on desperately. And hanging on desperately is what further sends her away.
Of course.
So now we know what the right thing to do is. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard because the other side of it is an abyss. Mm-hmm. You've got tears that could fill a gallon, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you got to let yourself shed those. You got to let yourself go through those more and more.
I feel like that's what I'm doing at this particular point. I am getting away from the kind of machoism that is inherent in my being and say that, look, I am hurting and I am going through a lot of pain and anger. It's not just the pain, it's the anger, because the anger, I think, supersedes the pain. It's almost like a Band-Aid on the pain.
And you know, Joe, I'll tell you something from what I know about you.
Mm-hmm.
Let go of the anger, too.
It's harder.
I know,
on.
Of course.
Because that's
of course, because that's the doorway to the abyss.
That's of course. And I've been trying to rationalize this situation and deal with it on.
So have you been in, do you have a therapist or somebody?
Yes, I do. With your help, I do.
Good. Yes, and you're going through it.
Yes, I'm going through it. And it's just funny that you were talking about the brain functions and all those facets that I was reading something the other day in a book, and they were talking about the narcissistic character and the inability for the narcissist, the extreme narcissist, to feel empathy. And I think that my partner, because of her experience in her life, it's very difficult for her to feel empathy in terms of the situation that we're going through right now. So that opened up a door to the other part of the book that I was reading about the reptilian brain and the fact that there's a part of us, a very basic part of our construct that is based on survival. And that part of the brain is the part that's most motivated in all of the things that we do. I don't hear you talk about it a lot. I think you talk about, you know, the hypothalamus and all these other parts. But that part, that very deep reptilian RH part, that fight or flight part, is the part that I think that I'm dealing with. And I am trying to abstract the situation.
Joe, let me ask, how old are you at this point in your life?
I'm 53.
You're 53.
We've had a 25-year relationship.
Okay, this is a great, great time.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to do it over, and you're going to do it right the next time. And if this time was wrong, and you got to pay the dues for that by letting it go, you're the kind of man who's got the introspection, the insight,
mm-hmm.
the ability to look at himself so that the next time around, it's going to be better, and you got to go through it.
Well, I am, but, you know, unfortunately...
You know, as one reptile to another, we'll make it through.
We'll make it through, but unfortunately, I have children in a situation.
I understand, and they'll make
difficult.
It through, too, because they're fortunate because they also have you.
Well, thank you very much, Armand, and,
nice,
and
nice
with
to
your help, with your help, I have been able to talk to somebody through your community that has been helping me, but it's just interesting that, you know, you're talking about this situation and these lockdown type mind processes that I'm dealing with right now. So thank you very much, Armand.
My pleasure, Joe.
Okay.
I wish we had more time.
That's okay. It's good enough.
Okay. Thanks. Sherry and Lauren, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Sherry. Sure, we'll be back with you soon. My friends, I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with more interesting stuff. Go to my website, thepositivemind.com.